is the Victorian Country Hour on ABC Radio Victoria.
Good afternoon. My name is Annie Brown. Good to be with you today. Now, this year marks a decade since the milk price crash that changed the dairy industry forever. When Murray Goulburn cut the price it paid farmers for their milk below the cost of production. And since then, the ACCC established the Dairy Code of Conduct to help level the playing field between processor and farmer. And today, the report into the second review of the code has been published. We're going to take a closer look and see what has changed in those last 10 years and since the code has been implemented and if it is working. And also, imagine having to relearn how to eat, write, and even talk. That is what one farmer had to do after an accident which left him with a broken neck. You're going to hear about this amazing story about the process of recovery, resilience of a marriage of 51 years, and also an important message for farmers about why you need to register your tractors and all of your vehicles on farm. We're also across to the Weather Bureau just after 12:30 today, so if you have a question for them, we can put it to them and see if we can get you a bit more information about your area. Send it in. Or if you have any thoughts or experiences that you want to share with us about any of the stories that we cover today in the program, I'd love to hear from you as well. The text line is 0467 842 722.
The Country Hour, celebrating 80 years in 2025.
Hi, I'm Darren Maddock, farming at Barranduda. Sheep and cattle, our biggest livestock is our compost worms though. Yeah, we've got a large worm farm here at Barranduda. We've got many millions of composting worms that we produce liquid and solid fertiliser from. I listen to the Country Hour from as long as I can remember. Knee-high to the grasshopper. Love it. Well, when the cattle prices boomed, I was pretty excited a few years ago. I listen to the Country Hour. I enjoy the diversity, the entertainment. Always keeps me up to date with what's happening in rural Victoria and Australia. Happy birthday to the Country Hour.
80 years of the Country Hour, Australia's longest running radio show.
After its second official review by the Department of Agriculture, Fisheries and Forestry, the Dairy Code is reportedly operating as intended. The Dairy Code was introduced back in 2020 as a mandatory code of conduct to fix significant imbalances in bargaining power between large dairy processors and dairy farmers. It is designed to ensure more transparent contracts, banning retrospective price cuts, and providing better dispute resolution for the industry. Overall, the review found the code is working, but also made several recommendations to provide farmers and processors greater flexibility and clarity when implementing it. Ben Bennett is the president of Australian Dairy Farmers. I spoke to him earlier this morning, and he said the code is extremely necessary.
Absolutely, the Dairy Code's working. We have to remember why, due to naughty behaviour of the processors stepping down their milk price after what they'd agreed to pay us. And in the last nearly 8 years of it, it hasn't happened. So I think that's a big plus. It's an insurance policy. It doesn't determine the milk price, but it's an insurance policy to give a surety that the price that they say they're going to give us is the price that we do get for the duration of the season.
So to take it back a few steps, the code was introduced 5 years ago, and it was there to help level playing field and following on from when Australia's largest milk processor, Goulburn Murray, announced that it would slash farm gate milk prices to below the cost of production, and then Fonterra followed suit. That was 10 years ago now. Can you take us back to that time and what it was like for dairy farmers?
Yeah. When back then, I was formerly with Murray Goulburn, but they sort of started over-promising, and they were getting sort of pretty cocky about things. And the price was quite strong relative to the international price. Fonterra had given warning signals that, hey, but they still pitched in at quite a strong price, but started to regret it. But that's what they gave, and that's how farmers went about the season to perform. And subsequently, the proverbial hit the fan. And Murray Goulburn was exposed for where it was, decided to renege on their price. Fonterra, I thought, well, we'll jump on the same bus. And, yeah, a lot of farmers, we're a high turnover, low margin industry. And when they hit us was in autumn, when our costs, and quite often, can supersede our income because we're setting up for the season, particularly for autumn domestic milk inclined farming.
So that was 10 years ago now. What have been some of the key changes that introducing this dairy code has made for dairy farmers?
When it happened, it left a phenomenally bitter taste in a lot of people's mouths. A lot of people got out of farming or shortly after that. And what this code has done is giving farmers a surety that naughty behaviour, there is legal regress against it. But it's all us very well saying, you know, on principle they shouldn't do this, but it needs a firm stick. That's what the code does. It gives that a surety, and that gives people the comfort to continue on farming, particularly in a high turnover, low margin industry.
So this review coming back saying that it's working, you know, that it's doing what it's meant to do, does that give farmers a lot of confidence going forward, do you think?
Well, Australian dairy farmers feels very much so. The process that of this review, we feel, was very good. The bureaucrats went through an extensive consultation process with representative entities. And if people want to hear their voice through the representative entities, they're sort of holding the reins. They did cast the net very wide. Other interested groups came along. Obviously, the processes also, they're very much integral in this. They spent their time doing it, and I think they were very thorough. And we actually commend them for that. We think that they held to the line pretty well. We're concerned about a few smaller issues that they've sort of given a bit of concession to the processes. But at the end of the day, it validates why we do have that code of conduct, to give farmers that confidence. And that's been a very big tick of acceptance.
There were also 8 recommendations from the review. So looking through them, a lot of them were about amending different paragraphs, engaging further with stakeholders. Was there anything in those recommendations that you would challenge or question?
Yeah, there were sort of 3 that we were sort of somewhat perplexed about, along with the ACCC. And one was the cooling off period. Okay, we feel the farmers need and deserve the opportunity just to ensure that heady time of the year, because we've only got one time of the year to make a significant decision on the income stream for our farm. Okay, they wanted that period shrunken from a fortnight down to about a week or so, and we were sort of against that. Like, if they were going to make a decision, they'll make a decision. And we just thought having that little bit of extra breathing time, reduce down the emotion of making a decision and giving them that comfort, I think is quite balanced. But that's where they landed on that. Another one is extraordinary circumstances. We're somewhat perplexed about that. We think it's a bit, there's a bit of an ambiguity about that and just what they're meaning. So that's sort of lost on us a little bit. So, and the other ones are just, they're quite tiny. But it's the old story, if you get into a legal challenge, those little incidentals, they get out there with a microscope. So, yeah.
The wording can be very important, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. But, look, on a whole, they fully accept it. We need that in the industry to ensure that we do have a good relationship with our processes, and they can stand by that. And that gives continuity of our business arrangement with the processes. So on a whole, we're more than happy.
With 5 years of the dairy code being in practice and in force, is there still a power imbalance between the farmer and the processor?
Oh, we definitely feel so. The industry is still very fragile. Over those 5 years or 10 years, when it first started, there has been a significant reduction in milk, and part of that is how farmers feel in the confidence of having a stable relationship with the processors. We're seeing over that 10 years significant changes in the landscape of the processors. Okay, Murray Goulburn's gone, Warrnambool Cheese and Butter's gone, and now we've got Fonterra in itself is about to be sold to Northern Hemisphere interests. So, but the code is still here. So these processes are sort of coming and going, but we need to have that stability to give us that assurance to operate in a challenging business environment.
I want to ask you as well, reading the Department of Agriculture's press release about this, their numbers and the stats that they put out say that dairy farm incomes are well above long-term average, milk prices remain strong, export has hit a record $3.7 billion last year. Is the Australian dairy industry thriving?
I think we need to sort of qualify all this. We're in an environment of significant inflation, and the reality is our costs are eating up on all those fronts. We've got big challenges with imports, be it cheese from New Zealand, America. We just had that incident with Woolworths masquerading butter from America. Like, it's where we need to be on guard and eyes open.
So yeah, still plenty of challenges within the industry at the moment that you're facing.
Absolutely. And costs are significant, like gas, electricity. Like, gas might not be direct, but it's indirect. Our processors need it, and the processors' costs will soon be our costs. So it's pretty fragile. There's a lot of pressure on all our consumers, and those are magnified at the farm gate.
I was also looking at some other numbers today with this review, and if we go back to 2015 when the code was introduced, there were about 6,000 dairy farms in Australia, and the latest numbers are sitting around 4,500, so that's at least 1,500 farmers who've left the industry in those 10 years or so. Do you think we'll ever see that number increase in Australia again?
Very unlikely. It's just... That's been the long trend for a significant period of time. The smaller farmers are consolidating into bigger farmers. We look at the situation in Western Australia, they are now under 100 farms. But that's just terrible. And that's going to affect the stability for the processors. But they'll end up, there's two or three processors over there. They only have to lose a couple of farms. And that's a significant... concerns for their continuity of supply. So it's not good for either the processors or the farming community to have reduction. We need our service people. More farmers, the better for them. They can spread their risk, spread their workload. But when it gets concentrated and concentrated, it does create a degree of fragility amongst our service people. But we need to do that inherently to survive.
And lastly, Ben, I guess the next review for the dairy code is set for, I think, 2028. Where do you want the industry to be by then?
I'd like the industry to be a bit more cost sensitive about when they make their decisions and how they're making their decisions. Okay, we need to make the milk at the cheapest cost point that we possibly can. We're staring down the barrel of an EU free trade. Their costs in agriculture in Europe are subsidised by $25 billion a year. We don't have that luxury. So therefore, we have to excel at our business management, which we do reasonably well, but we're going to have to fine-tune that even more.
That's Ben Bennett. He's the president of Australian Dairy Farmers and a dairy farmer himself in the southwest of the state, speaking to me there earlier this morning about the second review into the dairy code that has come out saying that the code is working as it intended to. There was also a media release sent out from the Minister for Agriculture, Fisheries and Forestry, Julie Collins. a few quotes to her say that the dairy is a vital industry for our country and makes a major contribution to our economy, and we want to ensure that it continues to grow in a fair and equitable way. The Dairy Code of Conduct is a mandatory framework that supports greater transparency and fairness in how dairy milk is purchased. I would like to personally thank the industry for assisting us in providing information and evidence on the operation of the code to inform the review report. Your input is valued, and we will continue to support Australia's dairy industry. That's from the Minister for Agriculture, Julie Collins there. If you are a dairy farmer or involved in the dairy industry, or maybe you previously were involved in the dairy industry, we'd love to hear your thoughts on the review of the dairy code. Do you think it's working? Has it made it better for dairy farmers? 0467 842 722 is the text line that you can send a text in. Or if you're feeling talkative, 1300 147 222 is the talkback line. Now, foxes and feral cats are two of the worst invasive species across Australia, costing the agriculture sector more than $198 million a year in losses and control costs. So with that, the Centre of Invasive Species Solution has welcomed a new national feral cat and fox management coordinator to sit alongside the coordinators for rabbits and wild dogs. Yasmin Ali is a couple of weeks into the job and will push for management and eradication where possible. However, this is an ongoing issue dating back to colonisation.
Well, they were both introduced. They've been here for a long time. They were introduced with European colonisation. Cats were intentionally released to help with the control of rabbits and rodents. And for foxes, they were introduced for the sport of hunting. Both species spread rapidly and now cover so much of Australia. So there's about 99% coverage for feral cats, and they are also on our offshore islands. And for foxes, it's about 80%. So they're not in the tropical north of Australia. And they do really well because they have so few natural predators. So, you know, really in terms of their opportunity for hunting and managing themselves, you know, their threat is really around wildlife, ag industry and our own human health. And they repopulate really quickly. So cats, you know, they can have a number of litters per year when conditions are good. So their populations will grow really quickly in areas where there's, you know, a good environment. And the same can be said for foxes. They tend to breed once a year, but still they spread and they can adapt and live in such a wide variety of habitats. So they are able to spread and live and thrive in so many different places across the country.
You know, a lot of primary producers listening will be familiar with the impact of foxes. You know, they can, you know, devastate livestock, cause a lot of issues. But something I never really thought about is also, I guess, with foxes and maybe and cats as well, is the spreading of certain diseases.
We know that they're both the most damaging invasive species to ag and wildlife. Not only through predation competition, but as you've mentioned, through spread of disease. They really, have the ability to transmit diseases such as hydatids, distemper, parvovirus and mange. They also spread weeds and damage infrastructure. And with cats, they can also spread toxoplasmosis. So, you know, those sorts of spreading of diseases into livestock mean that we see aborting of livestock young. It can really impact reproduction and productivity rates in agricultural settings. So it's not only the sort of physical disturbance they cause, but that spreading of disease is of real concern.
They're not great news when you paint the picture like that. What are some of the best control methods that we have for these animals?
Well, I think, you know, we have a lot of underpinning situations where we look at a specific environment and think, well, this is what we can do here. But I think sort of stepping back, probably the best approach we can always look at is taking something that's coordinated and collaborative as far as possible. So working with our neighbours, working within our communities to deliver a consolidated program that's targeted at the right time. And that might be for foxes in spring with lambing, you know, towards the end of winter to address the impacts of, you know, fox populations in those areas. So it's about thinking about your timing, thinking about who else you can do it with, and then what are the tools that we need to use to have the best effect. And often, you know, control measures, you know, using as many tools as possible will give you the best outcomes. So baiting, trapping, shooting, exclusion fencing, guardian animals are fantastic as well for things like chickens and ducks, and also for lambs. They can be a really effective means of control. And, you know, thinking about how and the timing of when you do that work to make sure that you're getting the best outcomes but also the best value for your money in the work that's happening at the time.
I guess this is a big picture question, but left unchecked, what damage could foxes and feral cats do?
It's pretty unlimited. And that given how far they've spread across the country, there's really no limit. And the thing with it is that they're recognised as one of the worst invasive alien species worldwide. They're both in that top 100, which is not a place that you know, we want them to be. And I think, you know, our focus needs to be around where we can achieve eradication, and that might be in situations like offshore islands or island habitats, where we can achieve, you know, localised control and reducing their impacts, whether that's an agricultural impact or an impact on threatened species, and where we can just sustain the control to just try and keep their population down as low as possible, because we know their impacts on our wildlife is so significant. You know, birds and our mammals, you know, they're responsible for so many extinctions in our country. We know that, you know, left unchecked, that number will only increase. So, you know, we don't want them to continue roaming vast distances and preying on all of our reptiles, birds, frogs and mammals, but also not preying on our livestock industry and impacting our agricultural environments as well.
What has been your previous experience working with invasive species before this role?
I worked for Parks Vic, and I've worked for Parks Tasmania as well. So working in the invasive species space for state government, I spent 20 years in Victoria delivering fox, cat programs, goats, pigs, rabbits and pest plant control programs. That, you know, starting out as a ranger at a localised scale in my park, to sort of protect birds in a wetland, to then, you know, working towards more broad scale programs as I progressed in my career, delivering landscape scale programs across eastern Victoria, you know, often in response to bushfire or flood as well. So it's something I enjoy, and it can really be a rewarding experience when you reach a point of reducing densities where you start to see our native mammals or birds returning to a site where they have been previously been predated by foxes or cats. It's a really nice outcome. So I do enjoy it. It sounds a bit weird, but I do.
Yeah, and it sounds like you know a few things about invasive species and some of these feral animals.
Yeah.
Yasmin, I guess for people listening, is there any message or anything that you hope people can take away when it comes to sort of managing invasive species like foxes and cats?
I think it's about having that awareness of where they are, and if you do see something unusual, if you're in a town or you're seeing more foxes in an area, reporting those. You know, we have really great citizen science tools on the PestSmart website, things like FeralScan, an app you can download to your phone and report in sightings that you know, in an unusual location where you might not have seen a fox or a cat before. So that's really a great way for us to build our knowledge of where the impacts are increasing or decreasing nationally. And I think also considering and thinking about, if you are going to be running a program, who are your partners? Who can you work with? Obviously, there are your neighbours, but who else a little further afield can be part of the program and help you to deliver more far-reaching outcomes? And looking at those opportunities for building collaboration and coordinated approaches to have those most positive outcomes on ground.
That's Yasmin Ali. She's the new feral cat and fox management coordinator with the Centre for Invasive Species Solutions, talking to me there recently about her new job a couple of weeks in. And if you're from East Gippsland listening in, you might recognise Yasmin there. She said she spent a lot of time out there working with Parks Victoria, doing a lot of different programs on invasive species. But I'm sure we'll talk to her much more in the new year as we continue to talk about fox predation and management, an ongoing problem for a long time. You are listening to the Victorian Country Hour. My name is Annie Brown. It is 12:30, so it means it's time to check in and find out what is making rural news. This afternoon, we're joined by Jane McNaughton. Afternoon, Jane.
Good afternoon, Annie. Holidaymakers and residents in Gippsland are being urged to take care following recent detections of Ross River virus in mosquito surveillance traps. The virus was identified in multiple traps in the Wellington and East Gippsland shires in recent weeks. Ross River virus is spread through the bite of infected mosquitoes, and some people may experience fever, joint pain and swelling, muscle aches, fatigue or rash. The Department of Health is advising people to wear long, loose-fitting and light-coloured clothing, use mosquito repellent and limit time outdoors during dawn and dusk. The federal government has announced there will be a gas reservation scheme operating on the east coast of Australia from 2027. Manufacturers have been calling for relief from rising energy costs, which they have blamed on too much gas being sold overseas. Energy Minister Chris Bowen describes it as a historic announcement and says it will reserve between 15 to 25% of the supply, which will put downward pressure on prices.
Most Australians think that Australians should have first rights to the gas that's under Australian soil, Australian waters, and that gas should be available to Australians at reasonable prices. And Australians are right about that. Most Australians think it makes no sense that Australia can be one of the largest gas producers and exporters in the world, and yet we have report after report showing us that there are gas shortages for domestic use in coming years. And Australians are right about that as well. The Albanese government will now move towards a gas reservation policy for Australia. A policy based on a preferred model of export permits for our three gas exporting companies and indeed anybody else who proposes to export gas in the future. We've consulted on various models, we've consulted on various options, but we've decided to support as a preferred model for further consultation the simplest, easiest to implement, easiest to understand model of not allowing gas exports into the future unless the government is satisfied that domestic demand is catered for first, and we believe that that can be achieved by a national reservation of 15 to 25%.
A multi-million dollar network of fire spotting cameras in southern New South Wales has already proven its worth, detecting smoke at times when watchtowers are unmanned. The New South Wales bushfire inquiry after the Black Summer fires recommended greater investment in remote sensing technology, like these AI-powered cameras for early detection. Emily Doak reports.
Over summer, Catherine Clark spends up to 10 hours a day in a high tower overlooking softwood plantations in southern New South Wales. She's not here for the panoramic views, but to watch for smoke.
When the weather's volatile, especially high winds, there's highways where there's a crash, machinery can do a spark when they're doing harvest time, hay can self-combust in their hay sheds, things like that can happen, and so that can start a grass fire and it can get going very quickly.
Catherine can't be on lookout all the time, but new cameras are using artificial intelligence to detect smoke columns and then deliver real-time alerts to fire crews. More than 36 of them are now operating in southern New South Wales over national parks, forests and farmland. The $9 million to install and run these cameras over 5 years has come from government and private investment. Executive Officer of the Softwoods Working Group, Carly Porteous, says already this season the cameras have helped to prevent fires taking hold.
Notifications of fires within minutes of a puff of smoke being detected. That doesn't mean that someone in a tower would not have picked that up quicker. But certainly what the cameras are doing are finding those black spots where towers don't currently exist.
And Queensland feedlots are leading the nation when it comes to shading cattle. A new report from the Australian Feedlotters Association shows 81% of cattle in Queensland feedlots now have access to shade. That's a big jump from 62% back in 2020. President of the association, Grant Gehry, says it's a voluntary move that's paying off, improving animal welfare, productivity and reputation.
People are installing shade for animal welfare reasons, to help manage cattle during, you know, heatload events. It certainly brings with it some animal welfare benefits and productivity benefits as well, especially in those difficult climatic conditions. We've seen a lot of R&D in this space over many years that's been done with MLA and Alpha through levy funding, and we've seen a lot of trials over that time that have shown performance benefits. We see benefits like, feed intake being maintained through hot weather. And we're seeing those sort of things that are really, coming to the fore and allowing people to go ahead and make the investments to put shade in.
And that's today's Rural News.
Thank you, Jane. That's Jane McNaughton there giving us the latest information of Rural News. I was also reading on that shade report that when we look at Victoria, 61% of cattle have access to shade in Victorian feedlots, up from 52% in 2020. So what's that? A 9% increase in 5 years. So maybe still a way to go to catch up to Queensland at 80%. Let's head to the Weather Bureau, though, and find out what is happening outside. We're joined this afternoon by Angus Hines. He's the Senior Forecaster at the Bureau of Meteorology. Good afternoon, Angus.
Good afternoon, Annie. Thanks for having me.
Good to have you on. It looks like it's a pretty sunny, mild day outside.
Yeah, mild is a great word to describe it at the moment across the state. It's a very settled pattern in terms of the weather situation that we're seeing over Victoria currently. We are seeing clear blue skies on and north of all the ranges at the moment. There is a little bit of cloud across our southern districts, right from the southwest through the capital and across to parts of Gippsland as well. And there's been a few very, very light showers this morning across the Gippsland area, but the rainfall observations have been in the order of 0 to 1 millimetres, so barely worth a breath in terms of rainfall today. And the picture is going to stay the same for the remainder of this afternoon. It is going to be mostly dry, a little bit of cloud in the south, clear blue sky in the north with next to no chance of rainfall. There is a bit of wind around, a southwesterly, just keeping those temperatures pretty capped, actually, for the time of year. We're seeing high temperatures in the 20 to 25 degree range across most of Victoria currently, which is a few degrees on the cool side of the ledger compared to the December average.
Well, farmers out harvesting will be happy to hear no sight of rain over the next few days. What about leading into Christmas? I think Daniel told us yesterday that we might have to pull out our jumpers.
Yeah, that's right. If you've got a lovely, brightly coloured Christmas jumper, this is the perfect year to pull it out because it might be necessary for parts of the state on Christmas Day. That's likely to be probably our coolest day of the week, actually, Thursday the 25th. Temperatures, even though they're already fairly on the cool side at the moment, dropping a few degrees between now and then, we'll be seeing temperatures in the teens across much of Victoria on Christmas Day, certainly the southern half of the state, potentially temperatures of around about 17 or 18 degrees through the southwest, through the centre, around Melbourne and across Gippsland, and the low half of the 20s across most northern areas between 21 and 25 degrees. So we'll be holding on to those temperatures that are a few degrees below average. We'll also be holding on to the other parts of the weather that we've got today. So that is to say, mostly dry conditions continue through Christmas Eve and Christmas Day. The only real area that could get sort of anything clocking up in the rain gauges is across both West and South Gippsland and East Gippsland. But again, it's going to be really low rainfall totals, potentially a few millimetres with some passing showers. But most people will get even less than that, with the vast majority of the state having 0.0 in their gauges between now and Christmas.
0.0, nothing for Christmas. What about in terms of wind? Any wind warnings out at the moment, Angus, or coming up in the next few days, you think?
There is a little bit of a breeze, yeah, across the state. So for mainland areas, that wind is not strong enough to give us any significant warning regions. We don't have any strong wind warnings or anything like that. But across our coastal waters, we are seeing some fairly breezy conditions, and there are some marine wind warnings in play for our coastal districts. Right across the west coast, the central coast, and through the central Gippsland coast and even the east Gippsland coast for today. So that's 20 to 30 knot winds across many of those areas today. A little bit choppy out there. And then continuing into tomorrow for at least for most of the coast as well. So another pretty windy one on Christmas Eve, likely to stay fairly windy out on those coastal waters for Christmas Day as well. So definitely something to think about if people are looking to head out and get a bit of seafood for Christmas. There's some pretty breezy conditions out on all of our coastal waters.
Anything else we need to know about or be across?
I would just say the next thing maybe just to keep in the back of the mind, and it's just in that slightly longer-term forecast outlook, is that we'll be seeing a real swing in our fortunes, certainly temperature-wise, heading into that week between Christmas and New Year. So once we get to about the 28th or 29th of December, temperatures really starting to warm up. We're swinging back to a northerly wind flow across the state, so we'll be back into the low or mid-30s for most of Victoria, and that could come with an increase in those fire danger conditions as well. Still something we're really honing in, those details in the forecast, but that's one to watch after a pretty settled and benign few days ahead.
Angus, thank you so much for your time this afternoon.
Thank you very much. Have a lovely day and a nice Christmas.
You too. That's Angus Hine, the Senior Forecaster at the Bureau of Meteorology, taking us through the weather forecast for the rest of today and the next few days. We check in with the Weather Bureau every day at about 12:35. So if you ever have a question, you are always welcome to send it in. 0467 842 722.
You're listening to the Victorian Country Hour on ABC Radio Victoria.
Sure are. My name is Annie Brown. It is 20 minutes to one. Now imagine having to relearn how to eat, write, and even talk. That's what Neilma North dairy farmer Colin Gray had to do after a farm accident in 2011 left him with a broken neck and a surgical hole in his windpipe. But he says it was a day like any other.
I did say to Jenny, I might go to Woodworkers Club, I might go up the fire station, or I might have done 10 other things like a typical father says to his wife when he's going to work in the morning. But I didn't. And I went down to another piece of land we had 2 kilometres away, and I was fencing with a post driver. I bored a hole, lifted the dolly up, and I'm not sure what happened. But anyway, I just heard a bit of a crunch and fell over on my back on the ground. That's where I was. I lay for 4 or 5 hours. When I hadn't come home for lunch, and she knew I'd been working at the other farm, she drove down the laneway, looked up the back and saw the tractor, and so she drove up, said, "What's the problem?" I said, "I've broken my neck." The accident probably happened about 12-ish, 11 or 12, and I got chopped to the Alfred Hospital.
No, that's all right. You just take a moment, don't feel like you have to answer this straight away, Colin, but do you remember much about your recovery after you arrived at the hospital?
When I got to the Alfred, I was in induced coma and I don't remember anything. People could talk to me and I could answer, but I just don't remember anything. So once Jenny was able to sign the paperwork to have an operation to release the pressure in my brain and put me spine back together a bit, I went into theatre to do that, and then 2 days later I had another operation from the front. It was a bone graft, and I stayed there for a week. Then I went to the ICU at the Alfred near the helipad where I woke up. So I knew before I left the scene that I couldn't move my legs, couldn't move my fingers. One arm I couldn't move, and yeah, I woke up. It is pretty daunting when you wake up, and I had a tracheostomy in, because once you've got a tube down more than a week, you've got to have a tracheostomy. So with my accident, I had to learn to write, I had to learn to feed myself, I had to learn to shave, I'd go to Pilates once a week, I have to have a massage to keep my body in trim. I couldn't talk. I had to use a board with the letters around it. Then I came home very ill prepared. I never had a tracheostomy. Our house on the farm was, I had to build another house for a share farmer. We lived in Warrigal for a year while the house was being modified for me to live at home.
So, Colin, for a farmer listening to this, you have a really vital word of advice for them.
Yeah. The most important advice I can give anyone is to have your tractor registered. Because in my case, the tractor was registered. Everything with a motorbikes, it doesn't matter what it is, it must be registered. So for my accident, it's covered by TAC. That's including chopper rides, ambulance, all my care, all my costs. It was probably $1 million the first year was spent in house modifications, care, and now, after 14 years, I've roughly worked out my care alone is about $1.2 million. That's to have 24/7 care, 24/7 care, full stop.
As you mentioned, Colin, you've got a team of carers and Jenny, your wife, as well. So what role do they play in your day-to-day life?
Carers come and go. The crew we've got at the moment, they've probably been the most stable. And for Jenny, Jenny's a carer, but if anyone can imagine, that we have to have people in our house 24 hours a day. And so Jenny works short shift, Fridays, Saturdays and Sundays, so that you can have some time on your own. And we have been married 51 years, which you see a lot of things happen when you have accidents, I can tell you now.
So Jenny's the real hero?
She is. When I was in hospital, she was probably in Melbourne 5 days a week. She used to come home a couple of days a week to, well, we had a few dramas here and there, pick up the mail. And then when I was in rehab, she was same sort of thing. And what happened with me, I came home for 2 weeks, got another chest infection, and I actually had to go back to hospital for 5 months. So I was away from home 16 months, and believe me, our friends, neighbours, and business people, they're probably the most amazing people I know. But I've actually said in life, sometimes what goes round comes round.
And Colin, I can't let you go until I ask you about the season, because you're still very involved in the running of the farm. So how are you looking as we head into summer?
Spring was up and down a bit, but October, November, the rainfall was bloody amazing. Our total rainfall here is about 830 to date. Our average rainfall's about 1,000, but we've had a good solid season. The farm's looking good. Could be drier than normal. You just got to keep that in your mind. But it has been a real turnaround for us.
That is Colin Gray. He's a semi-retired dairy farmer from Neilmer North, speaking there with Faith Tabouli, and an amazing story about how your life can change in an instant, but also about the support and the lessons that you can learn from that. Very great interview there from our rural reporter, Faith Tabouli-Yan. Let's look at some new research now, because research into blue-green aphids has identified the gene which detoxifies chemicals used to treat the pest and create insecticide resistance. Insecticide resistant in blue-green aphids was discovered in 2020 and causes headaches for farmers growing pastures and some crops. Dr. Joshua Tia, Melbourne University's Australian Research Council Fellow, says his research identifies a powerful gene which has important implications for the way farmers can try and treat aphid problems.
My research has been looking at the genetics of insecticide resistance in the blue-green aphid. The blue-green aphid is a really important aphid pest of Australia's grain and pasture industry. It attacks crops like lucerne, clover, lentils. And since the early 2020s, insecticide resistance has been discovered in this aphid. And part of my research has been understanding what is the genetic basis of this resistance and what can we learn from this genetic data to inform the management of resistance in the field.
And what did your research find?
So originally, insecticide resistance was first reported in the early 2020s. Came off the back of control failures to chlorpyrifos insecticides. And then from that, it was discovered that, you know, resistance to insecticides is sort of quite well distributed across, Victoria, New South Wales and South Australia. And using genetics, we wanted to know whether or not there are different aphid populations that have evolved resistance to insecticides independently with each other, or whether or not resistance has evolved from one population and then spread more widely across Australia. And so basically using genetics, we were able to show that indeed there's a single, what we call a strain of blue-green aphid that appears to have evolved resistance once and then spread across different growing regions in Australia. And the really interesting thing about this resistance is that a reasonable component of this is underpinned by a single gene. And this gene is called an esterase. And basically, this little esterase gene is like a Swiss Army knife. It's able to basically detoxify a range of different insecticides that are used to control blue-green aphid.
So this esterase gene that you've effectively uncovered sounds very powerful in these aphid populations. Is that what you sort of found?
Yeah, so this esterase gene is really interesting because it basically allows blue-green aphid to detoxify a range of different insecticides. So currently in Australia, the two main insecticides that are registered for use in blue-green aphid are carbamates and organophosphate insecticides. And in some cases, there are also pyrethroids, which can be used in blue-green aphid control. And basically, this esterase is able to protect blue-green aphids from all three of these insecticides. And so why that's really problematic is that basically, well, there are no control options, really. Any one of the three major insecticide groups that are used to control blue-green aphid can be detoxified by this enzyme, by this gene. And it means that any time a farmer or a grower uses these insecticides on a resistant blue-green aphid, they are increasing selection, you know, for resistance, irrespective of which insecticide they use. And this is problematic because typically one of the recommendations when there's insecticide resistance is that farmers should rotate the chemicals that they're using. But in this case, if they were to rotate through carbamates, organophosphates, or pyrethroids, actually none of these would be very effective at trying to eliminate resistance, and all three of them would actually increase selection for resistance.
So now that you've established this esterase gene, is it possible to test aphids in paddocks and out in the field so that farmers and people know, you know, that they are resistant to the chemicals that are available?
Yeah, absolutely. So based on the research that we've done, we've developed some diagnostic tests using molecular data. So, you know, we can do a very simple genetic screen, kind of like how you would, you know, for other sort of you know, conditions in the medical field, you know, we can use a genetic test to identify, you know, resistant aphids and the presence of this particular esterase gene that contributes to resistance in the field.
What control options do farmers have with this particular aphid that is resistant?
Yeah, in terms of chemical control, there are not really a lot of options. Another chemical called sulfoxaflor, you know, the product name Transform, is, you know, registered for use in blue-green aphids. That seems to be still effective against blue-green aphids, and that's one of the recommended, you know, alternatives for chemical control. But one thing that, you know, other groups are looking into are the roles of things like natural enemies, predatory insects like ladybirds or parasitic wasps that can be used as non-chemical control options for blue-green aphid. And really interestingly, historically, there's been a lot of work invested into developing cultivars of, say, lucerne that are actually more resistant themselves to aphid attack.
So what next in this field of research that you've done?
Yeah, so a really interesting question, I think, coming off the back of this research is how much further resistance can evolve in blue-green aphid and what contribution this particular esterase gene that we've focused on, but also others might have in increasing the sort of the magnitude of resistance that we see in the field. Currently, the amount of resistance that we see in the field is relatively moderate, but that does not mean to say that it could increase further with, you know, additional insecticide selection. And that would come about because, you know, extended use of chemicals that would increase the selection pressure on these aphids. And also because of the fact there are not many options for rotation, you know, to growers and to farmers, you know, any time that they use these sort of these more common chemicals to control for aphids in their paddocks, you know, this is going to intensify the selection and sort of increase you know, the impact of this esterase on the resistance trait.
That is Joshua Tia, University of Melbourne's Australian Research Council Fellow, speaking there to Emma Field. And while a test has been developed for the gene, he talked about it is not commercially available yet. Now, here on the Country Hour, we love people who love the country. And for one young vet, Eastern Victoria is the place to be. Lauren Turner hails from the Victorian High Country. And for the last 9 years, she's lived and worked in Talangada as a rural vet. She says her career was born from her love of the land.
Some kids, you know, they start from 4 or 5 and that's all they wanted to be. It probably wasn't necessarily me. But over time, I think I realised that it was certainly an option and, you know, getting out on farm and stuff was probably really enticing that way. So, not from the beginning, but definitely as I got older, and I definitely knew I always wanted to do something in the animal industry.
Mm-hmm. And so did you complete your studies here in Gippsland or in the big city or...?
Yeah, so after 4 years in boarding school, I wasn't that keen to stay in the city, so I was lucky enough I got in at Wagga, so Charles Sturt, and I studied there, which was great because, yeah, a little bit more rural. I enjoyed that a lot, so...
Did you miss being here on the farm while you were studying? And
yeah, I mean, yes, I definitely did. It was pretty good. I mean, we had quite a lot of holiday when we were at uni, you know, sort of 4 months over the summer and things. So you got back quite a bit. But yes, no, definitely missed it.
And how did you end up in the northeast?
Yeah, so basically I've been there since I graduated, so which is, pretty big stint for a first go. But, yeah, I guess I wanted a mixed practice. I was keen to be able to not just do small animals when I took on a job, but I was also pretty aware of getting a good supportive, you know, work environment. And there was a job going at Talangada, and I was very attracted by the mix. We're probably a very truly mixed practice. Like, we'd be 50% large animal, 50% small. So it's hard to find those sorts of clinics a lot nowadays, unless you're sort of going to straight dairy clinics or things like that. So got the job there, and it's a good part of the world and not too far from home. So, it sort of kept me there.
And what was it like trying to plug into a new community? Like, you've grown up in a rural community, but a whole different part of Victoria.
Oh, for sure. And it helps having grown up in a rural community because it's sort of, you know how they work. But I was also a netballer, so that was good, you know, getting involved with the local football netball club. I'm on the committee now over there. And also, I guess, just getting out on farm for work, you sort of, you know, you got to meet people, both in the clinic and on farm, but particularly on farm, meet and make connections that way as well. But so I think sport for me was, yeah, it was a good one and a good way of sort of getting involved with another rural community.
Mm-hmm. And what problems are front of mind for farmers at the moment? What are you seeing when you go visit them?
Yeah. Oh, look, I mean, there's always a variety. I think despite maybe not being as bad as some areas, you know, it still was. We've had a couple of really bad autumns over in that sort of Mida Kiwa Valley area. Some worst I'd seen in the time that I'd been over there. And so for them, probably people over here would say it's nothing, but for them, yeah, being quite dry was probably a big issue probably the last, 18 months or so. And I guess the commodity prices and things like that, and that same old everywhere, you know, generations, people getting older with no younger generations wanting to come on to farm. So, you know, seeing a few dairies going back into beef just as they get older and those sorts of things. But, yeah, it's probably the last 18 months or so, the season has been a big talking point like it has everywhere.
Mm-hmm. And you're back for a few days here at Bindi and Reedy Flat. So what are you going to get up to? Is it mainly visiting family?
Yeah, so I actually came over. We actually, the family still have a state forest grazing lease. So we actually walked a first mob of cattle for the summer up onto the Nuttyong Plateau. So, that was yesterday. So we're all a bit exhausted because it's about, I think, 4:30 we're up to do that. So I try and get back for at least one of those trips every year, and just for help. It was just the four of us, so my brother and my parents that got there. My brother's wife and my partner had work things on, so they didn't get over. So just the four of us, wasn't the nicest weather. We got a bit of sleety hail and things, but, yeah, we... that was the main reason. But in the meantime, just, yeah, catch up and help out where I can.
That's Lauren Turner. She's a vet in Talangada, but formerly from the east of Gippsland up in the Bindi area there, speaking with our rural reporter Faith Tabaluyan there, talking a little bit about how much she loves being from the country, which we always love to hear on the Country Hour. That's all the time we have for today on the program. Thank you for joining me this afternoon. I'll be with you tomorrow for our Christmas Eve Country Hour Might have some good rural-fired Christmas jokes for you if you tune in, if you like sort of punny, lame jokes. I've got a few up my sleeve. In the meantime, though, if you want to head on to our website to read a little bit more about some of the rural stories making headlines at the moment, head to abc.net.au/rural. It's a great story there about Christmas lychee season. It's been a good season this year, so if you love lychees, that's some good news. Also a bit more about the spread of varroa mite that's been happening in South Australia. We'll try to bring you some updates on that tomorrow as well on the program. But right now, though, it is 1 o'clock. It's time to get the latest from the ABC Newsroom. Have a great rest of your afternoon.